coming up on today's program.
So for the first time, and maybe the only time in my radio life, I began crying on the air. But I kept on reading because I had to. When the program was rebroadcast for the Midwest and then the West, the click and the credits were cut out. But I hear them still.
Remembering a public radio icon. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is Why So Weekend. As always, thanks for sharing your weekend with WISO. Coming up later in the program, we'll visit an ancient astronomical earthwork, and we've got an invasion of crows coming your way in today from the Ohio Newsroom. Up first, that voice you heard at the top of the show was public radio icon Susan Stanberg, who died this past week at the age of 87. She had a long and storied career, and WISO's Nina Ellis was herself a part of that career. Up first, on WISO Weekend, Ellis shares this remembrance in honor of her longtime friend.
Radio is the broadcast medium that's all about the power of sound, the emotion in a human voice, and music, too. If you were lucky enough to grow up listening to the radio, you know what I'm talking about. In the first half of the 20th century, it was the dominant broadcast medium around the world. It had music, comedy, news, drama, commentaries, and preachers. Live broadcasts were common. Someone talking to you in real time, that's what live means. From the radio, people learned to speak English, learned about triumph and tragedy in everyday life. On the radio, you can hear people breathe. And in the silence, you can hear them think. It's got more nuance than print, and unlike television, you're not as prone to judge by appearances. This week, we lost a radio genius. Susan Stanberg died at 87, just about a month after she retired from a 54-year career at National Public Radio. She grew up when radio was all there was, and she brought that power back to radio, to NPR, when it was new in the early 70s. She was the first woman to host a network news broadcast in this country. It was called All Things Considered. It's been heard here on WISO almost since it started. I was in college in Iowa wanting to be a broadcast journalist when I first heard her on All Things Considered, and I stood shocked and staring at the radio in my tiny apartment kitchen. Who is this? I thought. What's going on here? There were very few women on the radio back then, and they weren't like this. Laughing and funny, smart and challenging, sassy when she needed to be, tender when the moment called for it. I went to All Things Considered at NPR in my early 20s and worked as a writer and a tape editor, one of scores of people Susan taught how to make radio. You may recall that she hosted that program with Noah Adams in the 1980s, who I married, a marriage made in radio. They were both unlikely hosts, she, a woman, a very lively New Yorker, he, a shy guy from Kentucky. To many of us, Susan was a hero because she was a woman. But Noah always said he appreciated her because she was tougher than any of the men. You can hear hours and hours of Susan's stories at NPR.org, and I hope you will. But indulge me, please, as I play a very short radio story, an interview Susan did in 1986. Unbeknownst to listeners and most of us at NPR, Susan had been diagnosed with breast cancer, but she never mentions it.
A beloved All Things Considered commentator, Kim Williams of Missoula, Montana, although she said it much better.
This is Kim Williams in Missoula, Montana.
She was a naturalist. She gave recipes for dandelion wine. She gave advice on when you ought to get married, what you ought to wear. Audiences adored everything she said. And at the age of 62, she called to tell us she had terminal ovarian cancer, that her days were numbered.
Kim, something you wrote about a friend who was dying, and this very strong sense you have that death is merely a change, and that at some point you say hello to a whole lot of people who you've lost in this life.
Yes, and it is amazing how many letters I've already had before I put out that call, no more letters. How many I have received from people who say they are going to climb a mountain or walk along a river or on a city street, and they will send their thoughts and energies, and they think that they will meet mine.
Hmm. I believe that.
I do, too.
Kim, thank you very much.
Thank you, Susan.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Producer Nina Ellis, who edited that tape, left in the sound of the phone hanging up. I had to close the program and read the closing credits. I began, but the sound of that click got to me. It was so final. So for the first time, and maybe the only time in my radio life, I began crying on the air. But I kept on reading because I had to. We had to get off. When the program was rebroadcast for the Midwest and then the West, we roll it over the country, the click and the credits were cut out. But I hear them still. Every time I think about Kim's life and her much too early death.
It's so like Susan to give away credit. It was only working with her that made me understand that everyone could relate to that click. Susan came to WISO in 2012. She did a fundraiser for us at the Dayton Art Institute and came to the station, too, to meet with our Community Voices class. A few years ago, she did a Zoom event for us. Susan used her national exposure to bring people together by finding the humanity, the creativity, the commonality in people. She used her empathy to bring our nation together. She wanted people and small public radio stations like ours to thrive. Thank you, Susan Stamberg. I hope we will meet again.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. The Octagon Earthworks in Newark was built around 2,000 years ago with the moon in mind. The massive geometric structure lines up with a more than 18-year cycle that tracks the moon's rising and setting. People gathered last weekend to watch the northernmost moon rise through a gateway in the earthworks, as ancient indigenous people likely did centuries ago. For the Ohio Newsroom, WOSU's Ali Vagrinzik reports, and then we'll recap last week's Today from the Ohio Newsroom.
It's already dark out when dozens of people stream into the Octagon Earthworks Visitor Center. Jeff Gill, a volunteer interpreter with Ohio History Connection, explains to the group that even on a clear night like this one, they might miss the main event. Clouds could roll in.
It's not just half the time. It's way less than half the time. You do not see the moon at the point Earth breaks the horizon.
Even without the clouds, folks won't see the moon right when it rises because there are quite a lot of trees here. And it's not actually the northernmost moonrise in 18 years, but it's close enough to get a sense of what ancient people would have seen and experienced when they came to this place.
Stand where people stood 2,000 years ago and watch the moon, the same moon that they saw rise in the same place all those years ago. I mean, it's a way of connecting not only with these ancient indigenous people, but also with literally the cosmos.
Brad Lepper is senior archaeologist for Ohio History Connection's World Heritage Program. The Octagon and seven other earthworks became Ohio's first UNESCO World Heritage Site about 2 years ago. Lepper says a pair of archaeologists concluded the Octagon was aligned to the moon in the early 1980s. They were actually trying to disprove that ancient people aligned monuments to solar events like solstices. Their theory was that if you took any complicated monument and drew enough lines through it, you'd accidentally find a solar alignment. But the Octagon didn't line up to any solar events.
So then they said, well, maybe it's not lined up to the sun because it's lined up to something else.
That's how they found out that the earthworks align with where the moon appears and disappears on the horizon. Those places widen and contract over an 18.6-year period. The northernmost moonrise can be seen through a passageway of parallel earthen walls that links a large circle to the eight-sided shape that gives the earthworks its name. The moon last rose on or nearly on that axis in the mid-2000s. Lepper and Gill were there, likely the first people to intentionally observe that occurrence in 1,500 years. But they couldn't bring a lot of friends because the Octagon Earthworks was a private golf club at the time.
Some of us looked at each other and said, next time is going to be different.
2 decades later, they're finally able to share that experience with the public. Gill explains it before the crowd heads into the earthworks. Most people have seen the sunrise. The horizon gets light. The sun announces itself. The moon is different.
There's no signal. There's no advance notice. There's just darkness and anticipation and expectation. And then there's a spark.
When the time comes, the group sets out, carrying red light flashlights. A little line of crimson circles bob in the thick darkness as they walk. Eventually, they stop and turn their eyes to the horizon.
And the moon should be rising right over that mound that you see at the very end of these parallel walls.
As the minutes drag on, people fall nearly silent. All you can hear is the rustle of jackets and the shuffle of feet on grass. And then, it happens. A spark.
Coming through the tree there, the glow. You see the glow?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's doing it.
For an entire hour, 100 people watched the moon climb up a tree and break into the sky.
It was a little more somber than I was anticipating, you know, because everyone's standing there quietly.
It's just peaceful. You can think. You know, you can just take it in and smell the smells and hear the sounds.
I've never wanted to cut a tree down more in my entire life, I think.
That was Joe Suarez of Dublin, Julie Melendez of Bowling Green, and Andrew Self, the Octagon's AmeriCorps service member. They're all first-time moon watchers. Timothy Black of Newark has watched more than 30 moonrises or moonsets. He's a former news photographer and enjoys documenting these lunar events.
Is there something challenging or exciting about this?
Waiting. It's all about waiting.
For the Ohio Newsroom, I'm Allie Begrinsick.
Today from the Ohio Newsroom, Ohio's ode to a haunting bird.
Support for Today from the Ohio Newsroom comes from Ohio CASA. 15,000 Ohio children are in foster care at any given time. CASA volunteers advocate for these children. Information at ohiocasa.org.
Today from the Ohio Newsroom takes you around the state, connecting you with news and neighbors from all over Ohio. I'm Erin Gottsacker. Each Friday of October, we're exploring the spooky side of Ohio. This Freaky Friday, we're headed to Mansfield, where thousands of eerie black birds have filled the town. Some soar in on feathers, others are shaped from clay or paint, but all are unmistakably crows. Jennifer Beavis is the marketing and development director for the Mansfield Arts Center, which hosts Crow Fest each year. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So each year for Crow Fest, the Mansfield Arts Center showcases 100-plus renderings of crows made by Ohio artists. Can you give us a taste of what's on display this year?
We have pieces in every possible medium that you can imagine. There's a gorgeous carved crow that's completely carved out of wood. We have pottery, we have paintings, we have actually a full documentary that people can sit and watch. It's about 5 minutes long, dedicated to the crow migration here in Ohio.
Oh my gosh, that sounds so cool. Well, crows, I have to say, have a bit of a bad rap. They're noisy, they're ominous, they're even seen as harbingers of doom. What inspired you all to build a celebration around them?
At the Art Center here, we get thousands of crows that come and roost in the woods that are directly behind our beautiful building. And, you know, stepping outside, sometimes it's just deafening, cawing, and all of the sounds of the wings flapping and the crows roosting in our backwoods. And 4 years ago, we're a small team here, and we said, you know what, we have a 2-week window in between our next show. What if we just threw a pop-up dedicated to these crows? We can play the birds outside in our events pavilion and just make it a good time. And the response was amazing. So many people wanted to submit crow artwork. And now in our fourth year, it's really picked up steam.
What do you think it is about crows that people find so intriguing? You know, why are so many people drawn to submit work for an exhibit like this or just to come view it?
Crows have so many meanings from mythology and history. And, you know, we present these awards, too, that are, you know, puns or anything that celebrates what crows represent. And I think that really appeals to people to just really take a look at what these birds mean and how that relates to our city.
Has this art shaped the way you look at crows?
Absolutely. At my old house, it inspired me to become friends with the crows. And I had a small murder. So a murder is a group of crows that lived in my backyard. And I started feeding them. And they brought me little things occasionally, like sticks. Then I could always depend on what time. Crows are actually creatures of time. So they have very specific routines. They remember people. They remember your face. They can actually hold a grudge if you do them wrong. And they will pass that grudge down through generations of crows, which I think is so funny. But it definitely made me realize just how special and intelligent that these birds are and that they're definitely worth celebrating.
Wow. Well, if there's one piece visitors shouldn't miss on their visit to Crowfest, what would you say it is?
Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, I'm going to go with Best in Crow. That is a piece by Samantha Schneider, and it is ginormous. I mean, she made, I think it's 10 foot tall. I haven't measured it. There's crows giving her little pieces of candy from branches above that she painted. It's a giant whale painting. And she created these branches for a frame and all of these beautiful fall leaves around it. And then there are little gourds next to the painting that you can lift the lid and get a smell of fall to go along with the painting.
That was Jennifer Beavis with the Mansfield Art Center. Crowfest runs through October 31st. That's all today from the Ohio Newsroom. We'll talk with you on Monday.
You can usually catch Today from the Ohio Newsroom at 6:44 a.m. and p.m. weekdays on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks so much for tuning in. Up next, how about a little music? With roots in the Dayton area, Via has worked with artists like Anderson, Pac and Doja Cat, while also releasing music as a solo artist. Her newest EP is called Feels Good in the Shade, and she visited the WYSO studios on release day to talk with Assistant Music Director Evan Miller about the new project. Here's an excerpt from Evan Miller's conversation with Via live on the Midday Music Program.
You're originally from this area. That's how we caught wind of you at first.
I am, yeah. My parents were in the military, and they were stationed here when I was 9, so I spent my formative years here.
A tale as old as time, yep. In the Dayton area.
Exactly. Very relatable.
You were making music for a long time in L.A., and you've switched coasts recently.
Yep. I lived in L.A. for 10 years, and that's where I started my music career, backup singing for artists like Doja Cat, Anderson .Paak, people like that. And it really inspired me to go back to my roots and make my own music. So, I was touring and doing my project Via, and then the pandemic hit and I moved back to Dayton and just kind of started listening to all the emo, screamo, pop punk bands that I used to listen to when I lived here. And that inspired me to write and produce this EP.
Well, welcome back to the proper time zone.
Just thank you. Exactly. It really is.
The
it
real time zone. Yes. So, Feels Good in the Shade is this new EP you have out right now, ripped from a line on Violent, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, you were here for a little while during the pandemic, probably a little bit less chaotic place than L.A.
Oh, yeah.
Perhaps. And the writing process slowly developed for these. What is your process for writing?
This one was very unique to how I had formerly been making music because I was so isolated. When I was in LA, I had access to, you know, friends and other producers. But once I came back here, I didn't necessarily have a music community yet here. So I learned how to produce through a friend of mine. Her name's Alana and her artist name is Party Nails. Shout out. But she helped me learn how to produce. And I just like went up into my friend's attic and would spend like 8 hours up there just kind of like writing and experimenting and making really bad music until eventually I was like, oh, this is okay. I kind of like what I'm making now. So, but it took a while. It took months until I actually started liking it. And then just being back in Dayton and having like that nostalgic feeling and listening to all the old music I used to listen to, like, you know, Under Oath, Hawthorne Heights, Taking Back Sunday, Fifi Dobson, shout out, another black pop punk alt artist, Canadian icon. But yeah, I was like just listening to that, kind of picking and choosing what parts of those songs I really resonated with and why I liked them, and then kind of experimenting with my newly found production knowledge and skills and just sort of like, yeah, experimenting and making it happen.
Is there a particular song on this one that felt like a breakthrough or something, like you finally got at a sound you were reaching for?
Honestly, I think Arson, the one that you just played, is my favorite from the EP and another departure from how I normally made music. With this EP, I didn't necessarily want to sound like as pretty and like flowery as my other music. I really just wanted like the expression to come out. And so however it came out in the studio, it was like I leaned into my deeper voice. I have like a more alto tenor voice. And I leaned into that and just sort of tried to express freely. And even in the chorus, it's an instrumental chorus, which is very new for me because I wouldn't consider myself an instrumentalist, but I really wanted it. So I was like, this is what I'm committing to for my next music. I'm going to make instrumental music. So yeah, it was the alt pop kind of like folky country twang that I really was going for.
The instrumental version that got sent along with the normal version of this makes a lot more sense.
Oh, now. Okay, cool. Yeah. Awesome. I'm glad.
Thank you for setting that too.
Of course, yeah.
I noticed when you posted about this on Instagram, mm-hmm. I recognized somebody immediately in the credits of this. Barty Strange helped you mix some of this. Tell me about that.
Yeah.
We love him here on WISO.
He is very loved by NPR and WISO and KCRW, and very deservedly. He's an amazing artist, a really cool guy. We just kind of knew of each other through music and mutual friends and colleagues. And yeah, we finally ended up meeting this past year, and I just let him know how things were going with my project, and he was like, oh, well, we can make that happen. I was struggling with like finding people to like help produce it out and mix it, and he was like, I can help you, no problem. So he added some really cool production specifically to Arson and mixed it, and it sounds amazing, and I'm really grateful for him. And also, in case anybody's interested, he is going to be playing a show in Cleveland November 19th, and I'll be opening up for him there.
Nice.
Yeah, this will actually be my first time ever playing a show in Ohio.
WISO Assistant Music Director and host of the Midday Music Program, Evan Miller, speaking with Via, a music artist with roots in the Dayton area. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend.
Morning call. This is Bird Note. Millions of seabirds known as auklets call the Aleutian Islands home. But this volcanic, Bering Sea archipelago can be a treacherous landscape. In August 2008, Kasatochi Island erupted in the middle of auklet breeding season, burying tens of thousands of chicks in hot ash. At first, the auklet's future on the island appeared bleak. But in just a few years, the birds had returned in force. Thousands nested within the innumerable chambers left behind by sea-cooled lava. Volcanic islands are perhaps the only places that provide the complex of cozy cavities that can host copious amounts of fist-sized auklets. And the largest threats to these auklets' roosts isn't actually geological, but gastrointestinal. Over the years, poop from millions of breeding seabirds acts as fertilizers for thick mats of vegetation that slowly cover the volcanic terrain, choking off access to their nest sites. Eventually, the colonies abandon the island entirely to seek out less green pastures. Today, Kasatochi Island is as popular an auklet breeding ground as ever, and it will likely stay that way until transformed again by countless tons of poop or lava or both. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rummel.
Bird Note, telling vivid, sound-rich stories about birds and the challenges they face. And that's a wrap for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, community-owned public radio for curious listeners. Well, stay curious and tune back in next weekend where more comes your way. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for tuning in.
For roots music on WYSO, Sundays are the place to be. Wake up at 6 a.m. with Jennifer Berman and Chloe Maynor for a mix of folk, Americana, and bluegrass on Rise When the Rooster Crows. All Things Louisiana at noon with Lindsay Young on Louisiana Byways. Explore Celtic sounds with Cindy Funk at 1 p.m. with A Dear Green Place. If you like the blues, join Eric Henry at 3 with the Blues Revival. Then enjoy the old-time country sounds with me, Tom Duffy, on a country ramble at 6 p.m. That's Roots Music Sundays here on 91.3 WYSO and WYSO HD2 Novaphonic FM.
Join WYSO on Wednesday, November 26th at Victoria Theater as more than 25 of Dayton's most talented musicians gather to celebrate the music of the band. Such a night, The Last Waltz Live has been a Dayton Thanksgiving tradition for over a decade. Proceeds benefit WYSO. Tickets are available at DaytonLive.org.
presented with support from Stiefel, the GWR Group, and additional support from Piccolo Orsetto.